from New Jersey.
Thank you. Hi, good morning. My name is Billy Noonan. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since January the 5th of 1990. Very grateful for that. Member of the Design for Living Big Book Group in Wall, New Jersey, Sunday nights at 7 o'clock. There's no reason to really go there in the winter, but if you happen to be there between Memorial Day and Labor Day on the Jersey Shore, we have a great Sunday night meeting for you and lots of great meetings all around. You know, I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. That was some introduction. I want to thank last night's speaker. I look forward to hearing the rest. When I saw Sandy's name on the program today, I mean, if you haven't heard him, just a giant. You know, what Bill was saying, there's some people I think in this room. I know there's a couple who were last week in Barnegat. I spoke at a little event there, and so sorry if you hear the same thing, because I'm a big person who likes to talk about what's going on today. I can't just come up here and tell you the same story. And but, you know, speakers is such a strange world. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but, you know, when Bill said you don't get paid, you know, it's like asking someone if they get paid to be a GSR or paid to be good in a diner or paid to drive people to a meeting, you know, whatever their niche in AA is, because everyone has that gift that they're much better at sometimes. But, you know, I can't take you through the steps tonight, or this morning. I'm so used to speaking at night. You know, you got to do that one-on-one with someone else. But, you know, when I saw June's name on the program, you know, a speaker's job really is that maybe there's one person in the crowd who needs a little hope. You know, you can't take someone through the steps. I have a good friend of mine, Todd in Chicago, who is a real good friend of mine. He heard June, I want to say, in 1990 in Seattle. You spoke at that international convention, correct? She doesn't want to admit it because... But I'm just going to tell you that it's not, I'm not trying to lift her up on a pedestal. It's just that I know so many people, Todd included, that night when he heard her, and now I have the Chicago Lawyer magazine from 2 months ago where he was listed as he's one of the top lawyers in the new generation of lawyers. And, you know, you know, I hate when I hear people tell people that they can't do that, you know, especially in AA. You can't do what? You can do anything you want. Like, take all the restrictions off. Dream as big as you want. You can do whatever you want. The book is clear. Maybe there's, you know, and my good friend Tom I, you know, our alcoholic ego, which he reminds, you know, talks about so well, is that when you get a decent life in AA, you know, if you have an ego like I do, which Bill already told you I do, so I don't even have to admit it, my person who was supposed to introduce me has already told you, is that no matter what I succeed at in life, I have to still tell myself that I don't have power over the first drink, no matter what. It doesn't matter what I do. And, you know, for some people who were here last year when I spoke, I think, at the Young People's Conference, some people asked me about my brother. He's 9 months sober. He's doing great. Thank you for asking. I think some of you saw me last year. It was like a week after I had had a... Let's just say that I now fully understand what it was like to be my mother, you know? Let's just... I can end it, the discussion at that, you know? I have now been brought down to a new level of understanding of the misery and pain that I caused her. And like last night's speaker, I don't have any Al-Anon jokes. None. I have a debt of gratitude. I have a passion inside me for anyone who's a member of that fellowship, because I am clear that before I ever mouthed the rooms, the words that the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, I better have said right before that, that the first thing that happened was that the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Family Groups taught my mom how to deal with an alcoholic son like me and how to get out of the way of the bottom that God had planned for me. And that without the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon, I'm not sure if I would be your speaker tonight. If I had been continued to be enabled and continued to be embraced and continued to be, you know, all these other things. It's okay. It's hard to be Billy. All that other stuff. I'm not sure if I would be here and be your speaker. And, you know, just to get the quick math out of the way, I'm 42 years old. Hard for me to even really, really admit that right here. I'm a guy who's always wanted 20 years, and now that I know the truth about what comes with 20 years, for me, that truth is 44. I'm really not too interested in 20 years anymore, you know? If you had met me at 28, I was looking forward to having 20 years. There were a lot of people with time who I couldn't wait to just have a lot of time. And now, I'm more than comfortable with my 18 years. I was actually fine at like 15 and 37, to be perfectly honest. But I am 42 years old. I told you my sobriety date. The other thing that, just to throw it out, is that if you do the math, I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous for 62% of my life. You know, I came here at 15 years old, you know, at the end of my ninth grade in high school, in junior high. I haven't been sober since then, but that's a long time. A lot of my life centers around either in AA or around AA. In one way or the other, AA has been around my life. And, you know, as I said to some people last week, and the people who heard me last year, and I think what came across that day is, number one, you know, is I obviously had that thing going on with my brother, and it just, you know, put him in a psych ward, got him to a treatment center, and was pretty raw. And the other thing was, you know, I'll talk about being incarcerated and being sober, but I am, you know, I'm a, when I was not incarcerated anymore, I lived in New York City, and I am forever, I am such an urban AA, you know, that's just my AA, you know. Whatever your AA is, you know, I should be out of the judging business. I should be into the business of, God was at the first AA meeting and he hasn't missed one since. After that, it's really not my business about whether your group is a big book group or a speaker group or a service group. You know, I have a great talk that Bill Wilson gave to a bunch of people who got sober, not in AA, and the only thing he said to them was how much he respected them. And that his only job was to tell them, whatever you're doing, stick with it. And I have to remind myself that this right here is the only thing that's ever worked for an alcoholic like me. But who am I to be in the business of judging what works for other people? And forget about what works different than AA. Then I'm separating what works in AA. Oh, well, your type of AA is different than my type of AA. So now it's bad enough that now I have the dry people who don't go to AA. Then I have the people in AA that don't have my brand of AA. And last year, I was on fire about that. There's no doubt about it. And I can honestly tell you that only recently, in my AA experience, have I come to terms with that. And I think I was pretty honest about it last week that, you know, I can sit up here today and do what the book tells me, which is in a general way, stressing the word general, tell you how it used to be, how I got here, and how it is today. And it does, you know, or I could maybe try to prove to you that I've memorized the big book, but what real good does that do, you know? It does not say, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly memorized the big book. It just doesn't say that. And I say that because some of the best talks, if you want to call it quote-unquote big book talks I've ever heard, were from people that never mentioned a page number or never mentioned a chapter. But they sat up at some AA podium and told me about their life. And if you really listened, and they talked about how it used to be, how they got here, and how it is today. I mean, like I said, I used to judge people by rigid and militant guidelines of how you sponsor, how you read the big book, how you take people through the big book, and even judge talks like that. But to be perfectly honest, I'm much more interested in how's your life going today? How's your life at home? Are you able to show up for work? Like, do you have good relations with your siblings? Like, that's a true sign that what's talked about in the first 164 pages of the big book has worked for you. And a reason I was on fire last year, and you know, I try to be perfectly honest, and this is going to sound crazy when I tell you this, but it's fine, I've sounded crazy before, is I said last week, I said I had a little crisis of faith of myself in Alcoholics Anonymous that I just recently probably came to terms with in the last year or two. Not that I wanted to pick up a drink. Not that I thought the spiritual solution wasn't a spiritual solution for me. But that I had seen some things happen that had disturbed me greatly. Which one of them was somebody passing away. And what, you know, what had hit me the hardest is, you know, my friends, by the way, the title of your conference, Sunlight of the Spirit, the theme of your conference, title of it, that's kind of a code word for me and my friends, sometimes Sunlight of the Spirit, because if I really wanted to come here and not tell you how my life is today, I could tell you what I would tell you. I'm walking hand in hand with my Creator down the road. I'm in the sunlight of the Spirit. I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and thank God I found this group that does it this way. It would be very easy for me to come up with some kind of canned talk that seems to like get a lot of attention from people. But that's just not my spiritual truth. It's just not. You know, when I talk about myself reaching the steps or reaching the big book, you know, for me it was a Joe and Charlie workshop in 1993. I'm very honest about that. And as I tell you about my drinking, you'll hear I needed that. And then soon after that, I went to another big book workshop by another person who toured around teaching the big book. And what that had taught me at that time is that I needed something more. But I would never, ever, ever degrade AA by saying that up until that point, AA was killing me, or that other people in AA were, you know, cohorts in this crime of killing me. What I'm here to tell you is that up until I went to that Joe and Charlie Big Book seminar at 3 years sober, meetings, diners, young people's dances, and sober softball, God created them somehow. My God, my Creator, created them. And I was carried in the palm of my higher power's hand to a point where I realized there was something more to do. For me to stand at this podium and tell you that I was dying in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll be very honest, I've asked this question at the most militant big book seminars I've gone to. Show me one person who's written their inventory, including the last column, while they were drinking. I can't find one person to tell me yes. Which tells me that however bad you were saying AA is, it carried you to a point without a drink, whether it took 10 days or 10 years, to where then you realized you needed to pick up the spiritual toolkit of the 12 steps. And thank God. But it doesn't mean that time was bad. I mean, we get such in the business of judging. And I've spoken in conferences all over, and I've been to meetings all over. You know, my home group is a Design for Living group, but I don't want to put down the NYU group in New York City because I work in New York City. My office is in New York City. I go there 2 days a week at lunchtime. NYU looks nothing like my home group on Sunday nights. Sunday nights we have lots of very white people who drive very nice cars, who live in, for the most part, very nice houses. They're all alcoholic for sure, but that's just who are at the meeting. NYU, it's hard to find a straight guy. I would say 50% of the room is gay men or women. There's more ink and piercings than should ever be allowed probably in one location at one time, you know. And God is loud and present at NYU. That's just a fact of life. He's there. And, or she is there. Whoever you think is there is at NYU. And, you know, I came to that point last year when I talked about how crazy I am and the way I drink is I know my alcoholic truth. If you had met me on January 6th, 1990, and you told me that, well, all you did yesterday is not drink, that's not worth anything, you need to do this, 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 and this, that wouldn't be my story. My story is going to bed with the body and the chemistry that I was brought up with, and what goes on internally inside my system when I drink and take the first drink. Going to bed one night without drinking is a hands-down miracle. No doubt about it. Miracle. Now, did I need a little bit of time to learn that the way I live, that I am spiritually maladjusted, that I am inequipped for life? Yes. No doubt about it. Did I need finally somebody to put two and two together, that if I didn't change the way I was living, I might pick up a drink? Of course. No doubt about it. But to tell me that going to bed without a drink, maybe because I didn't do an inventory, and I didn't do this, and I didn't do that, maybe you don't drink like I do. And I just have to accept it at that point. Because, you know, I ran into a lot of people who started saying things like, a 90 and 90 is bad. Drunkalogs are bad. All these things I started to hear. And I started to wonder myself, do I join on a bandwagon and say what they're saying? Because where I live, there is a rigid group of big book people. Or do I tell my spiritual truth? But if I tell my spiritual truth, I may not be the most popular guy. And I like to be the most popular guy. But I have a job to do in AA, which is to carry my spiritual truth. My spiritual truth is that I love the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My problem is that I know more people had a meeting book before a big book. And a meeting book was definitely the first book they read before a big book. That's my spiritual truth, the people that I run into in AA. My spiritual truth is I know so many people whose lives have been changed by the 12-step process outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But my spiritual truth is a lot of them first did a 90 and 90, which led them to finding a sponsor, which led them to a big book. That's my spiritual truth. Not that a 90 and 90 is bad, or watered down AA, or the 12 and 12 is watered down AA, all these things that I'm supposed to gain on. And then the drunkalog, which I'm going to get into mine for a little bit, is I understand, you know, I'm of average intelligence. I understand if you're at a big book meeting or a step meeting, you talk about the big book of the steps. It just seems very clear. If that's what it says it is, it's probably what you share about. But I also understand what it says in the chapter Working with Others. The greatest tool I have to help a newcomer is not my recovery for immediate identification. It doesn't matter how good I am at the big book. It doesn't matter how good I am in AA. The greatest asset I carry is my past as a drinker. To reach that point of identification that only can be reached between two alcoholics who suffer from the same spiritual malady. And so at speaker meetings, where it's an open meeting and you're hoping maybe you'll give someone the hope to stay in AA for one more day and maybe get a home group and get a sponsor and get active, is how can you tell people to come to speaker meetings and not tell their drinking story? You know, I'm not saying that it should be the whole hour, obviously. But here's my spiritual truth. And like I said, I'm an average guy with average brains. But I will tell you this. If the first 8 pages of Bill Wilson's story did not exist in the big book, I would have not read the next 8. That's my truth. Why would I? There's an Al-Anon speaker named Mary Pearl. She says one of the greatest lines I've ever heard, which is, if I don't think you have my problem, I'm not going to ask you for a solution. So when you come up to a podium and you're telling a room full of newcomers, I'm not going to tell you my drinking story, how are they going to know that you suffer from the same spiritual malady? It's impossible. Bill Wilson's story is 50-50. Dr. Bob's is 70-30. If you don't believe me, pick up a big book. The first half, the first 104 pages in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, go back to 50-50 like Bill's story. First step versus the rest. That's just my story, my drinking story. You know, I'm Irish Catholic, obviously. That doesn't make me an alcoholic, you know? It just makes me Irish Catholic, you know? They say in meetings where I come from, it might make you a little bit more guilty and a little bit more thirsty, but that's it. You know, you cut it off at that. You know, it's not a reason for being an alcoholic. You know, my dad, you know, it's popular to say that, you know, I can't judge anyone an alcoholic. Well, he's an alcoholic, you know, he's an alcoholic. He died of the family liver disease. He died of the family, you know, passed on disease of active alcoholism at what's considered an early age. He, for most of my life, he was a very violent, angry, alcoholic, undercover narcotics cop. My mom was an untreated, codependent, Irish Catholic, Depression-era woman from Brooklyn. That's who raised me, with a lot of rules. It's like, you know, I'm sure some of you have heard Bobby C. speak. He's a really good friend of mine. A really good friend. But what about his story caught my attention, like, who knows now, 15 years ago? Because he described the house I was growing up in. The house I was afraid to talk about. The house where you don't talk about anything outside the walls. What goes on inside the house stays there. You know, and when I talk about, you know, drinking, you know, that family, like I said, it doesn't make me an alcoholic. But where do I come from? I believe in the family disease of alcoholism. I believe in that family disease. I was obviously affected by alcohol long before I picked up a drink. I'm also a person who took a little while to realize, you know, do I drink because I'm alcoholic or am I alcoholic because I drink? Well, I finally realized I'm not alcoholic because I drank a lot. I drank a lot because I was alcoholic from the get-go. Spiritually maladjusted from the get-go. And where did I come from? You know, I came from this crazy home. Now, when I got sober, it was a real different time. AA was a smoker's paradise, number one. If you saw me when I first came to AA in 1983, real smoker's paradise. And I love that about AA. Everywhere else I got detention or suspended, but not in AA. In AA, people would hand me a cigarette. And I told this story last week, you know, it's amazing how hard we can be on other people in AA, you know. I think what the meetings that are most important to me or that had the biggest impression on me, if you're ever in Manhattan, I'll just name a few and give them a visit. Living Now on St. Mark's Place in the East Village. Midnight Madness on Varick and Houston in the West Village. Chelsea Riverside at 69th and Broadway on the Upper West Side, also called Chock Full of Nuts. The 10 o'clock p.m. meeting at the 79th Street Workshop. You know, I love those meetings because those meetings are like MASH units for alcoholics. You know, I don't know, it's the only way I could describe it because, you know, if you're familiar with the show MASH or the term of, you know, it's like in New York City. Everyone talks about the hospital Bellevue. Now, if you talk to anyone that knows anything, they'll tell you, if you get shot, you want to go to Bellevue. Just long enough for them to save your life, because that's what they're really good at. People come in there every night, stabbed, shot, and they're really good at putting people back together for a little bit of time that shouldn't have been able to be put back together. And then anyone that knows what they're talking about, as soon as that happens, get transferred to Lenox Hill. Like, you don't want to be there for a long time. And, you know, when I talk about Midnight Madness and Living Now and 79th Street Workshop and Chelsea Riverside, those are MASH units for alcoholics and junkies, truthfully. People come in there who shouldn't be spiritually put back together ever again. And somehow those places are able to put them back together. And, you know, where I come from as a drinker, you know, my family, it would be when I came into AA in the 80s, everyone was getting sent to AA. Smoke a joint, you get sent to AA. Health insurance paid for rehabs multiple times at that time. I mean, it was a different culture, a different time. And, you know, but it was, I guess, in to say I come from a dysfunctional family. Well, what I could say is I come from a perfectly average family in my neighborhood. Alcoholic, codependent, untreated Al-Anon, violent, secret, stay in the house. Normal. Average. Everybody lives like that on our street. Everybody is a cop or a fireman or a union construction person. Everybody's wife is at home. Everybody's kids are scared of their dad. We were the first divorced family on the block, but just ordinary. And the other thing we were taught as kids is that drugs are bad. Drugs are bad. Drinking is what we do. We drink here. You know, we drink other people's drug. And my dad was obviously, I told you, an undercover narcotics cop. You don't stick it in your arm. You don't snort it. You don't smoke it, but just keep drinking, you know? That was the message sent out loud and clear. Now, that might be a good message if you're a social drinker. I guess not using drugs and drinking socially would be okay, but I'm not a social drinker. And then all the things I learned before I picked up a drink, you know? If I was going to hang out with my dad, I was going to have to be in drinking situations. If my dad was not at work, he was in a bar or a VFW hall or on a softball field. And so if I wanted to be with him, I was going to be in a bar. So, you know, by the time I was 12, 11 years old, I knew what an upside-down shot glass meant on a bar. I knew it meant you had a drink coming. I knew that every third drink was usually free for my dad. I knew that my dad took his money out of his pocket and laid it on the bar, that the bartender made change for him and left it there. I knew that my dad had a tab. I knew that there was usually, around getting close to the Super Bowl, a big poster behind the bar. It had numbers going down one side and across the bottom, you know. And I learned what a Super Bowl box is. And then, you know, my dad, you know, God rest his soul, if I could just, like, describe it the best, but he used to bring me home a piece of paper about this long. I don't know if anyone remembers them. Yeah. Every football game had a number. And you could circle a number, and then you decide how much money you're going to bet, and then my dad would hand it into his bookie for me. Like, I was doing that when I was 12 years old, you know, even with just $5. You know, but, like, that's just the culture that I come from. You know, I don't blame my parents for anything. It's just where I come from. And, you know, when I talk about drinking, when I talk about, like I said, I can't take you through the steps here today. You got to do that one-on-one with somebody. You just have to. But when I talk about drinking, it says in the doctor's opinion that we drink for the effect. When I talk about my first drinking experience, I'm not counting a lot of things. Because there were a lot of times when I got to drink when I couldn't drink as much as I wanted. When no matter what compulsion was there, there were exterior circumstances as a child that were present. Playing bartender for my dad and my uncles. Going on a fishing trip with my dad and his cop buddies. Going to Yankee Stadium and sitting in the right field bleachers with my dad and splitting a beer, splitting a Schaefer with him. Like, although that's drinking, it's not my drinking. That's what a son and dad do from the Irish Catholic section of New York that I come from. That's bonding. That's good quality family time. And you know what? I'm very proud of my dad. You know, I love him to death. Love him to death. Don't have too many regrets anymore about him not getting this program, but love him to death and know that he suffered from the same illness as me, and I suffer from the same illness that he did. And when, you know, when you're Irish Catholic, I have 42 first cousins, which, again, that's not a lot where I come from. That means my dad comes from 7, my mom comes from 9, they each have like 3.5, 4 kids, do the math, you have 42 first cousins, and what that makes is in the weekends during the year become like a revolving door of baptisms, first communions, confirmations, graduation from grammar school, graduations from high school. Like, once that chain starts and the kids keep coming, it's just a never-ending weekend cycle of these events. And, you know, I learned a lot about my family at these events, you know. I think back now. Back then I didn't realize. But I learned so much, you know. When I showed up for AA, you're looking at a guy that never lost a fight and never cried a tear. Just absolutely not true. But I would have told you that on January the 5th of 1990. I might have told you that you needed to write a new chapter in a big book, worst case to ever come to AA. You know? You know, garden variety was not something in my vocabulary. And the truth is that I got my ass kicked a lot. The truth is I cried a lot, but never in front of anyone else. You know, that's who came. But, you know, at home, you know, what I didn't want to tell you is, you know, when I was growing up, my dad would be gone for days at a time. He would come home. I'd hear the steps. If you're like me and you come from a family disease of alcoholism, you can hear the way the person comes through the front door and know whether they're smashed or whether they're okay. And that doesn't make me an alcoholic. But, you know, I often say that, you know, when you tell people that where they come from has nothing to do with how they're living, how much destruction are you doing in their life? It might not make them an alcoholic, but I learned how to live in that house. That is a crazy statement, you know, that I learned how to live at 52 West Drive. There was not a lot of good living lessons going on at 52 West Drive. So if you take away my alcohol and I stop drinking, which is why I love the Big Book. It's not that I'm anti-Big Book. I love the Big Book. I'm just so much concerned about the guy or girl with a couple of days and getting them one more day. Just one more day. But when my dad used to come through that door, and then I would hear the wedding pictures start to fly. Those are usually the first to go. And I'd hear the yelling. And we laugh about it here, but the truth is that I would be locked in my closet, crying, praying to a God I really didn't believe in, that my dad's weapon won't go off, that he won't shoot himself, or maybe shoot her and shoot him, that my mom won't grab the gun and do something crazy. Like, I didn't want to tell you that when I came in. But miraculously, with all those first communions and baptisms and everything else, when I get up 4 or 5 hours later, you know, my mom is making pancakes. My dad is already sitting drinking a little Irish whiskey, getting ready for the day. And we're going to go to church, and then we're going to go to whatever family event we're going to, and we don't even recognize what happened in the middle of the night. Like, whatever glass was broken is already picked up and thrown out. You know, it's not even as if it's a time warp. It's as if it didn't happen. You know, we do not recognize that that happened. And then we will get in a car, and we will go to this family event, and when we get out of that car, you know, we will not talk about what we witnessed the night before to any other family member. We just don't do that. And then you get there, and I learn my great relationship skills. You know, I'm very blessed. My fiance is with me this weekend. I got engaged back earlier this year, and you know, relationships obviously haven't been my strong suit for a long time in AA. There's no doubt about that. I'm the luckiest guy in the world right now. But, you know, let me just tell you where those great relationship skills started. Because you can't go down to Borders or Barnes & Noble today and find the Noonan Family Guide to Raising a Healthy Family. And, you know, what I say is, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I suffer from what it says in the Big Book. I've never been able to take one drink without starting the compulsion inside my system. It's just a fact. And tomorrow when I wake up, unfortunately, even though I haven't taken a first drink, and even though there's been massive consequences from the night before, my body tells me the only way to feel okay again is to take the first drink. Absolute insanity. Alcoholic nightmare to be in that cycle. I mean, it just is. But when I would go to those family parties, men would go here, women would go there. One of my uncles would bring a couple of decks of cards. If it's New Year's Day or Thanksgiving and there's games on, maybe a bookie's phone number for some last-minute calls in on the game for the latest line. Somebody would bring singles and quarters. The men would never talk to the women. Maybe at Thanksgiving we'd all join for dinner for a little bit, but then we would be back at the tables. And, you know, I would want to be there dealing or playing cards or making drinks or getting beers for my uncles. And, you know, the end of the night always ended the same way. Same way. Either my mom or one of my aunts in a verbal or physical altercation with my dad or one of my uncles about driving home. Because, see, in my family, men are men. Just leave it at that. We're men. You know, we drive somewhere, we drive home. You know, no woman's going to drive me home. No woman's going to take my keys and put me in, like, the child seat. You know, it's just, we laugh about it. And I say this, you know, if you're a person who's sitting here who's lost a person or had a person in your family injured by a drunk driver, I assure you that my job is to respect you. I'm not making light of drinking and driving. There are no funny drinking and driving stories. there are just drinking and driving stories. That's all there are. I'm not a person who, you know, I'm a person who got in one of those bad accidents that someone didn't walk away from. And I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened to me lately is I spoke at a meeting not too far from my home, and I had said that, and a woman came up to me at the end of the meeting. She was like 38 years sober. She hadn't been to meetings for 2 years. She just recently started to come back because she couldn't take people in AA. She had, her daughter was killed by a drunk driver when she was like 35 years sober. And she said that she was going to meeting after meeting, and all she would hear people say is, "But for the grace of God, thank God my God chose me. Thank God my God protected me." And it was so hard for her to hear that God decided to take her daughter. Like, who is anyone to say that? Even myself. You know, we use God as such an excuse for bad behavior in Alcoholics Anonymous, of progress, not perfection. You know, that somehow that God is responsible for my car accident. You know, God gave me and a lot of other people I've ran into self-will. And I have that will for a reason. And if I go out, you know, when I hear people say, "Well, you needed to do that. You needed to stick up 17 banks." I'm not really sure. You know? You needed to, like, cause that much, like, we say keep coming back. Why not just stay here? Stay here. This is a much better way of life. You know, it's a much better way of life. And I'm not putting down because I was in and out for 8 years. It's just we always forget about the people who don't come back. That's the silent majority in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I say when I'm speaking from a podium, who do I owe an obligation to? Nothing against people with time, because I think we need more old-timers in AA meetings. I think we need to do whatever we can to let the old-timers know that we need them in our meetings. We do not need the Billy Ends who are 5 years sober and experts on the big book. We have enough of them. There are so many of them. We need more newcomers, and we need more old-timers. I need the old-timers who have their grandkids' pictures, who have wound up making it through life 20 or 30 years, paying their bills, being a decent family person, living up to their obligations. Like, I need those people. I don't need people who can quote pages. You know, I need people who have done this. As they say, you know, in the literature, it's a way of life. A way of life. And the way of life I was taught just doesn't work. You know, and in New York, you know, I wound up coming to AA, and so many stories I could tell you. But when I came to AA, I was kind of tricked. I wasn't going to school a lot. I was late a lot. The school filed a little order with the family court. One of those provisions was that maybe I should go to some meetings. And there was a great high school counselor, Mr. Pavi, God rest his soul, but he really made an influence in my life. And that's, you know, when I say that about newcomers and meetings is, I know that if I say, if there's someone in here with 35 years and I say something you don't like, chances are you could care less what I say and you're coming back to AA. But if you're in here and you have a couple of days, the podium is powerful enough to make you maybe walk out that door. I have an obligation to not do that. I have an obligation that the newcomer, keeping you in AA is my primary purpose. You know, not doing anything with this podium that could send you running out the door. Not telling you you have to do that, you have to be a member of this religion, or you have to believe in this God, or you have to do this. My only message is, if you hate AA and you don't like AA, you're a lot like me. And the only thing I would tell you to read is the first two paragraphs of the first tradition in the 12 and 12. If you think that AA is going to strip you of your individuality, take away who you can be, deny you of your life, then I suggest you just read those three paragraphs, because it's like the anarchist national anthem. If you read those paragraphs, it will tell you that no other fellowship in the world respects your right to be an individual more than this one. And that you have a right to act as you wish, dress as you wish, believe in the God you wish. That's our obligation. And I love that line. It may mean that some people don't dress like I want them to dress, but the line is clear. It's not as Billy sees it in that paragraph. It's the Alcoholics Anonymous conference approved literature. And, you know, if you're new, I didn't think I had a drinking problem. The problem was I thought I had a drinking gift. You know, I don't know if there's any of you like that. You know, like, I thought I had a drinking gift. And so it was hard for me to rectify that the one thing that I was really good at and excelled at, all of a sudden, people were telling me was a problem. Like, come on, I'm not the best looking guy, I'm definitely not the best athlete, but I can drink these people under the table. I can sit across in so-and-so's mom's kitchen with a shot glass in front of me, and I can bounce quarters off a table into that shot glass until 4 o'clock in the morning. You can put the center of the football team across from me, and I assure you that he'll be puking before me. Like, I wore that like a badge of honor. Like, that was a badge of honor. And, you know, my drinking, it worked for me. You know, as I go back in time a little bit, I'm 12 or 13 years old, and I finally drink for the first time, real time. Not with my dad, not with my uncles. I got my own 8-pack of Miller, the small bottles. I don't know if you remember that 8-pack, but it was classic. And I'm in the back of, like, a typical car at that time, like a Nova or a Chevy, you know, a Le Mans, a passed-down Nova, a Duster, a Monte Carlo, typical Cutlass Supreme. You know, it has a huge radio with a huge equalizer. It has, you know, somebody took Budweiser bottle tops and put them around the volume controls. And I'm in that car listening to, like, Black Sabbath or Pink Floyd, and I have my first 8-pack. And that night, my life changed. I might have not known it that night. I might have not known it in a couple of months. But you see, if I need to tell my drinking story quick, I can tell you that prior to that, I was a pretty decent son. I was an okay student. I was a good Boy Scout. I was a decent kid to have on your baseball team, but I hated myself. Hated myself. Whether it was because of the family life around me or whatever, but I hated myself. Within a year of that 8-pack of Miller, I was far from a good student. Not a great son. Not a good Boy Scout. Not a good kid to have on your team. But for the first time in my life, I loved myself. I actually liked who I was. Now, when I see a 13 or 14-year-old kid in AA today, it looks very young. No doubt about it. It is very young. But my drinking story is this. I can't take it. I can't give you mine. Just don't take mine away. Is that by age 13, what I can unequivocally assure everyone in this room is that I'd lived long enough hating myself. It had been long enough. And once I found something that gave me the ability to like myself, it didn't matter what the consequences were. Consequences do not matter. I spoke last week at this little mini conference, and there was a woman who spoke before me, and I loved what she was talking about, because she was talking about what a decent life in AA can do for you. And if you come, you know, like, I'm a guy, I have a great career today. A great job, great friends, I told you, a great fiance. But there's a time in my life when I went from living in the Penn Station train terminal, sober, to living in a single-room occupancy welfare hotel, where that was a huge change for the positive. And then I went from that welfare hotel to the couch in a one-bedroom on the Upper West Side. And what I loved about this woman who spoke last week was the message of consequences just don't work for us. A decent life. Now, the problem with a guy like me is I want the 20-year life at year two. You know? That's what I want. I want the life of a guy with 20 years with the work required in 2 years of sobriety. Because I'm a guy who likes to do as little work as required. It's just been my story. I'm a guy who got all great grades. If you saw my report cards, I'm dating myself, but there would be red lines, and the teachers still used blue and red pens, both sides. You know, it was a dual. I was a big red pen guy. And but my grades would always be in blue ink. I have an 85, a 92, maybe even a 98, an 85. Except in the red, the next column was attitude. And I would have a big red U with like a 3, 4, 5, and then you turn the report card over and you look up those codes. Unsatisfactory, doesn't show enough effort, doesn't show come on time, unprepared for class. Like, that was the story of my life. Like, I've always been able to take tests. I've always been able to remember things I read. But don't ask me to do work. You know? Work is where I draw the line. You know? And I say it all the time that I don't, when I speak, I don't mean to be offensive. Because I respect the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous too much. But I also say that, unfortunately, I lived in a very offenseful way. I did not drink and conduct myself in a way that made me a good person. I always say that by the time I was 16 years old, as bad as it sounds, you know, I had like 3 goals in life because of the guys that I wanted to be just like. I wanted to get drunk, get laid, and avoid work. Like, if I could do those 3 things, my life would be going okay, you know? And I'm a guy who was raised to be a bigot, a sexist, a racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic. The list is long. Like, that's just where I come from. And not the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, as I was in AA as a teenager, like I told you, I loved that you could smoke here. Loved it. I was in and out for 8 years. I didn't come dressed like this in 9th grade, I just want to let you know. In 9th grade, if you caught me, I would have on black engineer boots, Levi's, an Iron Maiden or Black Sabbath concert t-shirt. I had a olive drab green army 3/4 length jacket I wore in the winter that had the WHO Quadrophenia symbol painted on the back of it. I had a dungaree Levi jacket, which was like my real whole identity, that dungaree jacket. And on the back, I had an Ozzy Osbourne oil painting. As I got up to go out for school in the morning, my fiance is laughing because we drove here yesterday and I was controlling the radio, and I go in satellite radio from like death metal to Hair Nation, you know, like that's just it's where I come from, you know, I'm still a heavy metal junkie. And I would put a pack of cigarettes behind my belt buckle in case I got searched in the bathroom at school. You know, that's just who I was when I came to AA. And, you know, I remember when I saw my first anniversary meeting, you know, I so identified when I heard my friend Todd, who I was talking about earlier, because we had the same response at our anniversary meetings. You know, I kept hearing about these anniversary meetings when I was a teenager. Can't wait to Friday night. Big anniversary meeting. Like, everybody was looking forward to this meeting. And then Friday night came, and I'm sitting there, and some, like, old person, like 30-year-old, went and turned off, like, lowered the lights, and the sheet cake came out with candles on it, and everyone started singing happy anniversary. And, like, I'm thinking to myself, well, this is exactly why I am not going to be here for the rest of my life. Like, I had a much better life in store for me, you know? And you know, in my last couple minutes here, I want to tell you about getting sober is that, number one, what you hear in a meeting might not be what's in our literature. So I'm going to tell you this. If someone says something in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that makes you think, well, maybe I'm not like them, or maybe it won't work for me, or that'll never work for me, you need to talk to someone with time and find out if what you heard can be rectified in the literature. Because if it can't, it's not AA. If it can, it is AA. You know, the best men in my life are not men that give me answers. They're men that tell me where the questions are in the literature. And that where those answers to those questions are in the literature. And, you know, when I hear things, I used to hear these sayings. You know, one of my favorites, top 5 that I can't stand, is my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. Not my story. I wish it was. It's not my story. I think I know where they got it from. It bothered me for so long, I think I finally found the page in the big book. On page 43, it says something to the effect of, I would not trade the life I have today for the life of yesterday. Fair enough. It's an easy question with a guy like me. Would you like today's life or the life? Easy. But I always say, you know, checking into a maximum security correctional facility at 5 months sober was not better than spring break 1985, you know? Like, just be very honest, you know? Let's be very honest, you know? And I'm very clear on that, you know, that I wouldn't trade my life, but I say that because, you know, I met a young kid last week I was driving to him a meeting on Sunday. And, you know, we have to be so careful. Everyone has a different story in AA. Everyone needs hope from a different place. Everyone has different crosses to bear when they walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he lost his license for 20 years. And someone who still has their driver's license and never lost it is telling them they understand what it's like to be him. How is that possible? How is it possible? Even I can't say that to him. I lost mine for 6. I can tell him what it's like to lose it for 6. You know what I told him? It sucks. It sucks. I don't know what else I can tell you. I can tell you that we can try to help you stay sober a day at a time. You can build a realistic life plan around not having a license. And you can have the greatest life that God ever meant you to have. And you know what? You don't have to listen to anyone else who's never lost a driver's license who tells you they know what it's like to be you. They know what it's like to be an alcoholic. But don't confuse circumstances with the disease. Newcomers are so into circumstances. A newcomer's mailbox, like me, is filled with letters. They're just from the wrong people. They're from the warrant division and the probation department and all these other places that just, they seem to have, I can't even imagine how it must be today with the computers have advanced so much. They must be even better at it, but they were so good at it 20 years ago. But, you know, I've been sober now 18 years. I told you I went to a Joe and Charlie Big Book study. I told you I was having a crisis of faith in AA. And 2 weeks ago, I had to go down to the boardwalk in Belmar. And I was saying last week that in my contacts list in my BlackBerry, I haven't been able to delete people who've died. Just can't do it, for whatever reason. Just haven't been able to remove their name. And it's one person's name who died I wrote a letter to 2 weeks ago. Now, I talk to this person all the time. Not all the time, but enough, let's just say. That's no longer with us. But I decided to put it all on paper in an email because I still have his email address and I fired off. And I say that because this person was an excellent teacher of the Big Book, but had left the fellowship, had become so rigid in the program and left the fellowship, spent every weekend traveling but had no equals, had no peers. I always say, Friday night, a couple of Friday nights a month, if I'm around, I play in a small game of Texas Hold'em with a bunch of other sober guys around the table, usually 10 guys there. There's usually about 80 DWIs, 50 orders for child order reinstatement, child, you know, support, assault charges, drug possession charges. And the day that I would rather be speaking at a conference rather than at that Friday night card game, you won't see me here anymore. You just won't. I need equals in AA. I need men who went down this road before me. I need newcomers. But I need equals. I need peers. And, you know, I just want to give a quick plug for, you know, the other thing that drives me crazy in AA is when I hear people say, I've never been to jail, so I can't bring meetings inside. Such a crazy statement. Especially because if you talk to a guy like me, I wasn't allowed back in for a little while. Most of us that are in and get out, they don't let us back in for a little while. Their preference is to keep us out as volunteers. And we have to work. We have to work to get clearance. I have a yellow card on my desk at home from the Monmouth County Correctional Facility. I'm very proud of that card, because the people they're hardest on clearing back in are ex-inmates, which means that the sober men and women, and I say sober because their time in jail counts, who are going to meetings and in the program, need people who've never been arrested before. They need people who can fill out those forms and not have to check yes, turn over the page if you checked yes, and please add a narrative. I have so many narratives in my life between volunteer forms and work applications. I think I'd like to put them on eBay and sell them, you know, because someone else in AA helped me write them. So I just want to tell you, we so need people to do that. And service, you know. We would all not be sitting here if there's not someone sitting in a room somewhere who's answering a phone because someone is reaching out to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hear people say, oh, service is politics, service is this. Listen, if you think that and you're at a service meeting and the topic of discussion is anything, anything but bringing this message to the still suffering alcoholic, tell them. Maybe no one's told them before. Maybe they're so busy discussing something that has absolutely nothing to do with getting this message to someone who hasn't heard it before. But everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, has to be, the people who aren't here yet are why we have a service structure, not for the people who are here. We forget that all the time. If you want to get involved in service, it's not to become the king or queen of AA. It's to make sure that the light bill and the telephone bill and the copier and the computer at your local intergroup are still on, so that when someone picks up the phone, the most important, critical, spiritual agreement in Alcoholics Anonymous between us and the newcomer, so that when someone picks up that phone, someone answers. And that someone who answers has a meeting book that some inner group printed. And they have a 12-step list from groups that sent people's names in, that they can put that newcomer in contact with, that they can send them to a meeting that still exists. You know, I just got done serving 4 years on the Trustees Correctional Facility Committee as an appointed committee member at GSO. And I had the privilege of being an area delegate, and, you know, but on the correctional committee the last 4 years, just such, you know, for a guy like me who was in a correctional facility 18 years ago in my first year of sobriety, 16 years later, I'm on a committee that's picking new stories for inmate to inmate. And then last year, I had the privilege of chairing the subcommittee of making the new video to send to all the wardens in the U.S. and Canada of what AA is and what it isn't, and trying to stress to them in this video, you know, why volunteers bring in meetings. It's not to be do-gooders. It's not to bring stuff into inmates. It's because if we don't stay sober. End of subject. But, you know, Cliff R. from Florida, he'll kill me for saying that, from California, Oceanside. He says it best, you know. Everyone has their gift. Maybe you work miracles on the way to meetings with a newcomer in a car that other people just can't do. Maybe you can answer the phone on the hotline and you're able to talk to those people calling like some other people can't do. Maybe you're a great speaker. Maybe you're a great GSR. Maybe you're a treasurer. But the bottom line is, we need all of you. Every single one of you. And, you know, my mom, and I'll close with this, you know, my life has been blessed. I have so many great friends. And my dad died of alcoholism in 2000. When I left, my first sponsor in New York City was a black guy. So funny, you know. We used to walk down the street. He'd have his Malcolm X movie just came on. He'd have his Malcolm X hat on. I'd have my Notre Dame Fighting Irish hat on. You know, I grew up in a family where there was never black people out in our house, you know, and he taught me more about being a man than anyone else in my life. In fact, what he taught me was, most of the things I was taught made you a man don't make you a man. And most of the things I was taught that make you not a man make you a man. I mean, amazing the stuff that he taught me. But my dad, I used to, me and Winston, he lived on 120, Tiemann Place in Broadway in Harlem. We'd walk down the street, and I'd pray to God, like, God, why did you screw me? Why does my dad still get to drink? Why does he have all these medals from the police department? And when I kneeled at my dad's coffin in 2000, with all his medals and all the flags and the honor guard there, and a whole room full of people, some who he didn't talk to, and I don't know why, because he didn't know why. That's just what we do in our family. We just tell you we're not talking to him, you know? But they show up at the wake. But when I got up from kneeling and saying a prayer at his coffin the last time, I can assure you I didn't ask God why I got the bad hand of cards. My dad was legally blind from diabetes and drinking. He was missing his leg from diabetes and drinking. His liver was completely distended. So that's my dad. But I had no unfinished business. What a gift. My mom died in 1999 of cancer. Again, and this, I swear I shut up after telling you this, is my mom and me had a rough go at it for a long time. When I found out she was sick, I was very upset because I felt like God was ripping her away from me. Like, she didn't let me back in the house for Thanksgiving and Christmas my first 2 years sober because she thought that she owed her other children a safe place to be home from college. I hated her for that. Then when I went home third year, I couldn't wait to be back with all the AA people, you know. It's like, you know us. You know us. We want something as soon as we get it. We want something else. But my mom had cancer, and December 24th of 1999, I wrapped her last Christmas gift on her Christmas table, on her kitchen table. I had just left her at the hospice with my family. And watch my other siblings drink, and was devastated. I got up early the next morning to go visit her. I was the first one out the door. We knew it would be her last Christmas alive, as did she. We had decorated the room. We had pictures of her cat. We had her crazy Irish music on CD, and we were having family, you know, come over to the facility she was in, and. You know, I got up early that morning and got her wig, her Charlie perfume, her makeup, and two large Dunkin' Donuts coffees, and I went and saw her early that morning, Christmas Day, 1999. And, you know, I jumped up into bed with her. It was all propped up, and we were throwing back. We might as well have been throwing back, you know, a couple of tall boys of Budweiser, you know. And we're throwing back some coffee. And I'm putting on her makeup and her, as best I can, and putting on her wig. And, you know, if you've ever dealt with someone who's dying of cancer, sometimes they hallucinate a little bit. And sometimes you don't know if they're with you or not with you. You have to check. And at one point she said, you know, Billy, what AA gave me is the ability to go get a quart of milk. And I was... What are you talking about, Mom? You know, like, what are you talking about? And I was wondering whether she's hallucinating. She said, what you don't understand is that there was a time in my life when if I needed to get something from the store at night, that I would rather do without than go out to the store and hear the hardest question for me to hear, which would be, how are your kids? Or how is Billy? Like, I would rather stay home and do without hearing that question. And she says, what AA gave me, I don't know where it gave me it, but it crossed a magic line to where I couldn't wait for someone to ask me that question. I couldn't wait for, and, you know, she was the biggest violator of my anonymity in the world. But you know what? What are you going to do, you know? I mean, I just destroyed her life, you know. She's just a disaster of a son. And all of a sudden... You know, and when I work with young people and new people, I think it's hard sometimes for parents to understand, you know. They think that all the love and all the money can put Johnny or Jane together again. It's so hard for parents sometimes to see that it doesn't work. that, you know, we can put them back together again. And, you know, my mom would just say, you know, how proud she was of AA, you know, for giving her a son back. And, you know, what more could you want from life? I mean, God, I've been given enough. And, like I said, if you're new, you hate AA, you hate a guy in a suit talking to you, we got a lot in common, you know? We got a lot in common, you know? I mean, I was just at a meeting not too long ago, I was saying last week, and I saw a young kid outside, and he was smoking, like I smoke, you know, the way I used to smoke cigarettes. And a young kid, but you could see, tough as nails. And some person in AA came up to him and says, "Does your parents know you smoke?" And, you know, talking to him like he was not an alcoholic, but like a child of someone at the meeting. And, you know, I almost tore this person's head off. I didn't, thank God. But I said enough to let them know, you know, I said, you know, believe it or not, his parents are very happy that he's not, like, smoking crystal meth and crack and drinking Jack Daniels right now. They're very accepting of the Marlboros right now, you know. They're doing okay with the Marlboros, you know. But, you know, we never know who's going to be at a meeting. And that's, you know, my mom. My mom was given back her son by Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the speakers, and thank you for having me here today.